we have underestimated how much autonomy central banks have. We have underestimated how much interest rates and exchange rates that we observe depend on the reaction of central banks.
Welcome to another Vox Talk recorded at the Paris School of Economics CEPR Policy Forum 2026. I'm Tim Phillips. Our country wants a stable exchange rate. It wants money to flow freely across its borders, and it wants to set its own interest rates. Economists would say, pick any two, because you can't have all three. But history doesn't quite follow this pattern. Eric Monnet of the Paris School of Economics has investigated more than 100 years of dusty central bank balance sheets to discover why not, and he joins me now to tell me. Eric, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hello, Tim.
First of all, this trilemma that I mentioned, it's quite a famous trilemma, isn't it? Why should it hold?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it's quite a famous thing. I mean, all economic students study that as an undergrad. I mean, it's called sometimes a Mundell trilemma after Robert Mundell, who formulated the trilemma in the 1960s and got the Nobel Prize, actually, for this idea. But when Mundell formulated this idea, it was in 1960, so it was just after the reopening of the world capital markets, of international finance. You know, it's something called the Bretton Woods era after World War II. I mean, for one decade, international finance is almost no functioning. I mean, it's years of Marshall Plan, and then it's reopening, and you have like financial institutions doing arbitrage and financial market and so on. And so then country realize that then when the financial institution doing this arbitrage, I mean, it's a problem for the autonomy of monetary policy, because it means that one central bank that wants to set the interest rate, when it's setting the interest rate, if financial institutions are doing some arbitrage and then going to the country where the interest rate is higher, then it's a problem for the central banks because it creates capital flows. So the idea of the trilemma is to say, okay, if you're in an open economy, it's impossible to get a fixed exchange rate without capital controls, because it means that you cannot really maintain the fixed exchange rate because the differential interest rates are going to weigh on the exchange rate. Either you put capital controls or you shift to a floating world of exchange rate. And this is extremely influential, and this is why a lot of countries shifted to floating exchange rate, especially after Bretton Woods and until the 1990s, saying, okay, if your exchange rate is floating, then you can regain monetary policy or autonomy by setting the interest rate. But then came other influential economists, prominently Ellen Ray and so on, who say, okay, it's more complicated than that, because then actually we have a dilemma. Because even country with a floating exchange rate, they cannot really have autonomy of their monetary policy for something we're going to talk about now.
Yes, it's always more complicated than that. I said at the beginning, history hasn't followed this pattern. What hasn't worked in quite the way we might expect?
What we talked about previously is a model, I mean, the theoretical model. Mm-hmm. And the world, obviously, as we know, it does not work as in our theoretical model. So in the real world, I mean, there are many what we call market imperfections, okay? Meaning that there are not always people or financial institutions doing this arbitrage between interest rates or exchange rate across the world. So actually for a very long time, even in countries which are reasonably financially open, I mean, trilemma did not really bind because actually they were not really full arbitrage. So this is called like transaction cost. Okay, you cannot do the arbitrage. So I mean, it's a good news for central banks, we might say, because it gives some monetary policy autonomy. So that's one thing. The other thing is more related to the idea I was mentioning before of the dilemma. It might be worse than what we actually thought, because there is something what now economists call a global financial cycle, a global risk aversion. Okay, meaning that, I mean, the idea behind that is that, for example, when there is a shock on one emerging market, you know, these financial institutions that invest everywhere in the world, they're going to say, okay, there is a big depreciation in Mexico, and that probably happened to be the same in Chile or in Peru, which are countries which are associated by financial institutions. So actually, it makes the thing worse, because then all this movement in exchange rate or interest rates might be driven by a common global financial cycle or commercial risk aversion, what we call the risk aversion, meaning that the big financial institutions, I mean, they're not ready to take risk, and they ask for either higher interest rates or stronger depreciation of this exchange rate to be compensated for the risk they take. So it makes the thing much more complicated than the theoretical model.
You had some intuition about something else that might be going on behind the scenes here. What was that?
Exactly. So for the moment, I've just explained, you know, what economists know, what they've talked about. So this idea of the trilemma and this idea of the dilemma, and that everything is more complicated because there are transaction costs or global risk aversion in the economy.
Yeah.
But they forget something which we know is important, nonetheless, is central banks. Okay. We always talk about central banks. We know they are important, but mostly we talk about them. We talk about interest rates. But they're not only setting interest rates. They are financial institutions themselves. I mean, they have a balance sheet. They do a ton of operations all day. They buy securities, they lend to commercial banks and so on. What we did in this paper with Guillaume Bazot and Mathias Maurice is to say, okay, well, let's take central banks and especially central bank balance sheets, so their financial operations, not their interest rate, into this big picture and this very standard international macro framework. And this changes quite a lot of things. Because when I talk about this global risk aversion of global financial cycle, but then you say, okay, these central banks, they can intervene on the market. So if some markets of some financial institutions, you know, they are a bit worried and they ask for more compensation for the risk, central banks can provide them liquidity. It can be done either through domestic loans or purchase of domestic securities on the domestic money market, or through what we call foreign exchange interventions on foreign assets. And this changes quite a lot of the picture because this gives central banks much more autonomy than what the standard frameworks usually tell.
The way that central banks make decisions and the impacts of those decisions have been fascinating economists for more than a century. Podcasts got to it a little bit later, but we are catching up. So for more on this topic, listen to our episode, The Bank of England's Capital Mistake, from March 2026, where former Bank of England insiders David Aikman and John Vickers explain why they think that the bank's decision to cut equity capital requirements for UK retail banks could increase the likelihood of a financial crisis. You will find it when you follow Vox Talks Economics, wherever you get your podcasts.
So if you're going to analyze this, what data do you need?
So that was the big thing. One of the reasons why economists have been neglected this issue of financial operations of central banks is that it's quite difficult to get very detailed information on their balance sheets and financial operations, especially at a quite high frequency, because we're talking here about like international markets. So everything, all these arbitrages, they are happening in weeks or months and not in the annual balance sheet that you usually see.
Right, because it's quite easy to get the annual balance sheet.
Annual balance sheet, you get to the annual report of central banks. It's been there forever. I mean, this weekly, monthly data, I mean, they're usually much more difficult to find. And here we were quite lucky. I mean, we are a team of financial historians, so we know the archives and we spend a lot of time in the archive. You know, by chance, at some point, we found in the archives of the Bank of France, so the French central banks, that actually these central banks had been collected since the late 19th century, all weekly and monthly central balance sheets of all the other main central banks in the world.
No way.
I mean, it's very interesting when you think about it, of why they were doing that, because it was actually the foundation of the research department of the Bank of France. The first time they decided to create a team of economists, of research economists, was exactly to do that, was to track all the financial operations of all the other central banks in the world. In the late 19th century, and they start doing this data collection starting in 1891. And this is why we start our sample in 1891 for about like 20 central banks, 20 economies, which correspond at that time to almost all central banks in the world. Because before World War I, central banking was really a European phenomenon, and also Japan. And then also the US joined the game with the creation of the Federal Reserves in 1913. It's only starting in the 1920s, 1930s that central banks created in other parts of the world.
But for most of this period, this must not have existed in digital form. There must be a lot of ledgers.
Yeah, exactly. The sources we use at the Bank of France are really on written pages. I mean, they copied this central bank balance sheet that they get from their fellow central bankers. So we have the correspondence. We knew that they were asking the balance sheet from the other central banks, and they had to translate it because at that time, you know, it's not today where central banks are extremely transparent. They publish everything in English in their financial statement. At that time, this was not the case. And we see that this French economist at the Bank of France, they get the data, they translated everything. I mean, and their main skills for which they were recruited at the time were actually the ability to know a lot of languages, you know, Finnish, Japanese, and so on. A lot of Eastern European languages also at the time.
Okay, so you have digitized this data?
So we digitized everything. And then the big deal was to understand exactly what was behind these numbers. Because as I told you, I mean, central banks have done a lot of very different operations at that time. We were helped a lot by the fact that this French economists, I mean, they kept a lot of notes with them. But still, I mean, we needed to build like consistent categories to compare what can be comparable. Because, I mean, one of the big things, especially, was to distinguish between the financial operations that are potentially moving the interest rates or the exchange rate, which are the one we are interested in when we talk about this trilemma or monetary autonomy, and then tons of other operations that central banks have been doing in their history, which have nothing to do with the money market interest rate or exchange rate. And when you know history, you know that central banks for a very long time, and they could do, for example, long-term loans to the government, or sometimes even long-term loans to some industries, specific companies, or some big development banks. And we have to isolate these kind of loans, which are in themselves very interesting. So we have other projects to work on this, but it's really not related to what we are talking about here, which is the ability of central banks to intervene on financial market to provide short-term liquidity.
How do you do that? You automatically do it, or do you have to manually make
No, the digitization of the sources, I mean, this can be made automatic in some ways, but then understanding the balance sheet, something you need a lot of expertise. You need to cross-check with, first, I mean, the notes that were left behind by this economist at the Bank of France, and then a lot of secondary literature, you know, some what economists have been written about the central banks, and also the annual report of the central banks that sometimes give also interesting information on the operations they were doing. So it's a lot about understanding the exact financial operations and not something that you can automatize.
So once you've isolated the relevant data about these central bank interventions, what are they doing day to day? What did you discover?
So what we have really discovered is that these financial operations, they are really reacting to international interest rate changes, okay? Which was quite surprising because when people talk about central bank balance sheets and operations, they will think about reactions to financial crisis called like lender of last resort. They will think about like monetary policy, including like quantitative easing, but they would not think that central bank will systematically react when there was a change in the leading interest rate. So what is the leading interest rate? I mean, this is usually the interest rates of the leading central bank in the world. So for a long time, this was the Bank of England. Today, this is the Federal Reserve, the US Federal Reserve. And we know, and there's a lot of literature on this, I mean, done by other colleagues, that this interest rate of the leading central bank is really moving the international financial markets. Okay, it's really set the tone on all financial markets in the world. And then what we discovered is that the other central banks, they are not only reacting by moving interest rate, but they're actually reacting by providing liquidity to their own market to tame the effect of the increase in the leading interest rate on their domestic money market or exchange rate. And this was quite a big discovery. I mean, we really did not expect that this was something that will be absolutely systematic. Okay, we find this, it's all open financially economies since the late 19th century. And that's very important for economists like us because it means that, you know, a lot of variables that we have been observing for a long time, like exchange rate, interest rate, actually what we see, I mean, the fluctuations of these variables, they are dependent on the reaction of central bank balance sheets, on central bank assets. And it's something which is actually quite strong, but have been quite neglected in the previous literature, that all of these variables, I mean, they should be interpreted conditionally on the reaction of the balance sheet of the central banks.
And this is going on across 130 years in various countries, different monetary regimes. It's consistent activity.
Yeah. I mean, this was really what one of the most surprising results for us, that across all these different periods, as long as economies are financially open, so as long as their currency can be traded on international financial markets, central banks do react, meaning that their domestic assets react to the changes in the world interest rate. And it's surprising because the operation that central banks are doing have changed a lot over time. I mean, when you think, for example, about international reserves, what we call foreign exchange interventions, I mean, for 19th century, they were doing it by gold or with deposits in foreign banks. Today, they're doing it mostly with securities, U.S. securities, so U.S. government bills. So this has been very different. On the domestic side, I mean, central banks used to be what is called like discount loans, discounting commercial bills, which was for a long time the main loan that central banks will do. Today, they do open market operations. They buy government bonds. So this is completely different. And still, I mean, we still observe a reaction of central bank balance sheet, meaning that this idea of providing liquidity to the market, whatever the form, whatever the operations, it's been absolutely systematic in economies in the 19th century.
It's been systematic, Eric, but it hasn't been secret, has it? So why are we not more aware of it?
It's not secret. I mean, to be fair, a lot of the things we are saying on, especially foreign exchange interventions, I mean, it's not a secret. It's something that they have a bit of difficulties to rationalize it. I mean, it does not fully enter the model,
yeah.
But it's known. I mean, it's known. The fact that they will react by expanding domestic liquidity to these international shocks, I think was something which has really not fully understood. Again, it's not complete, it's not secret. I mean, these are operations that the financial institutions will know. I mean, the banks, they borrow from the central banks. But these are the kind of things that we're talking about, like very detailed explanation that have not yet been fully integrated in the way economists think about financial globalization.
So this shock absorber, has it worked better in some financial systems, some countries than others? Has it worked best where there are most shocks, where you would think there would be most activity?
Yeah, so you used the word shock absorber. And I think I can explain a bit more why central banks can really do that. And it's for a very simple reason, is that central banks have no constraint to create money. And this is quite a big difference with other financial institutions, like yeah. The big banks in the world. I mean, the reason why there is this risk aversion, we're talking about global risk aversion, is that the big banks, even like the very important wealthy banks, they have to care about their balance sheet profits and so on. So they cannot fully create money. So sometimes if they think that if they see some risk, they will limit their operations. And central banks, they don't have to do that. I mean, they can take all the risks they want because they have the ability to create money freely. So this is why at the end, they have the ultimate shock absorbers in financial globalization. But then, as you say, not all central banks can do that very well. And there are two reasons why the ability to do that might be limited. So the first one is when central banks actually, they cannot really intervene on the liquid market. You know, if actually the domestic banks are not borrowing from each other, so the central banks cannot really play this role of shock absorbing because there's not enough financial institution to which it can provide liquidity.
Uh-huh.
And the second reason, which actually is a bit related, and it's quite tricky issues for many emerging markets today, that sometimes the domestic banks, they can be indebted in dollars. So then the ability to provide domestic liquidity is quite limited because it means that it will always be foreign exchange interventions, even for domestic banks. And there have been a lot of paper recently showing that things are more difficult for emerging markets, especially to manage their interest rates because of this issue. But people who have made this diagnosis, I mean, they have a bit forgotten that the reason why the central banks have difficulty to manage the domestic interest rate is because of this constraint on their balance sheet.
Even though some central banks might have had more difficulty using these interventions than others, is the story here that we have underestimated how much autonomy that central banks have had over the years?
So clearly, and this is really the main message of the paper, I mean, is that we have underestimated how much autonomy central banks have. We have underestimated how much interest rates and exchange rates that we observe depend on the reaction of central banks. The conclusion is not that central banks have full autonomy, because we are saying that they can use money creations to tame the effect of global risk aversion. But if really your currency is not credible, you can spend a lot of money and at the end, I mean, the financial market will win. So everything that we are seeing here is something that works well in contexts where there is still sufficiently credibility in the currency.
It's an economic detective story that really makes us think again about how central banks function. Eric, thank you very much for talking about
it. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you. the paper if you want to read it. Discussion paper 19646 at CPR, Central Banks and the Absorption of International Shocks between 1891 and 2019. Authors Guillaume Bazot, Eric Monet and Mathias Mori.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next time on Vox Talks Economics, three of the next generation of economists talk to us about their exciting new research.